12. The Shelter of a Cave. Knowing what length Sketlish was interested in, and understanding his methods, Martha Einkorn had purchased, via the Fantail Future Safe Foundation, Admiral Hunsey Island off the coast of Papua New Guinea. Within the bunker, using the landscape's natural caves, she had built an extra bunker, just in case. In designing it, Martha Einkorn had operated on Lenk's guiding principle that several hundred people should be able to survive and thrive there without leaving for a minimum of 300 years. None of the others, Lenk explained to Chun, because he really did love to lecture, had thought it through. When the sea level rises, Zimri's place in Haida Gwaii would be underwater, even if Chun hadn't blown it up. Ellen's Mountain was in an area of seismic activity. They both thought they were only going to be there for 5 to 10 years at the outside. But Lenk Sketlish thought much more long-term than that. It wasn't a surprise to learn that the future-safe wildlife conservation zones had been designed to benefit their owners as much as to protect the natural environments. Shun and half the people under 40 on the internet had already presumed this was happening somehow, even if only in access to these precious areas, in monetizing images of them. The scale, though, that was a surprise. She walked with Lenk through the corridors tunneled from the rock, miles of them. The mountain had been drilled into an ant's nest, a colony, solid and dark, sleeping places, latrine holes positioned so that the highest tides every day would sluice them clean, stove places with chimneys letting their smoke out high on the cliff face. The start, if you had to start human civilization again. Here, inside this mountain, were no large supplies of canned goods or guns or digging machines. What Martha had stocked here, from the eastern reach touching the ocean to the western edge overhanging the forest basin, was anything you could realistically protect or learn to create or to repair as a small, well-educated community over several hundred years. Enochites, Shun thought, the way they wanted to live. This had been Lenk's reason for wanting Martha after all. There were thousands of arrowheads and instructions on how to make arrowheads, shafts and bows, dry stuffed bedding, and diagrams showing which plants to dry and fluff and spin to make more, clay pots and notes of precisely which mud to use and which wood burned hot enough to fire them. The first 270,000 years of Homo sapiens' technical development preserved against the oncoming tide. There was more, of course. One could always hope for more. An explanation of germ theory was carved into the walls in words and pictographs.
If we can pass one thing on, this is it, right? Small, alive things, too small to see, make you sick. You have to wash to keep them away. That's a lot of suffering prevented right there.
Chun saw that this was real to Lenk, more real than the current sickness sweeping the world. The future was more real to him than the present. There were long rows of plasti-paper books full of more advanced knowledge in each of the 20 most commonly spoken languages on Earth. Quantum theory, general relativity, the human genome, the manufacture of an electron microscope.
No literature? Said Shun.
Oh, sure, that's in there. Martha's a big reader. She says that's what gets us from one world to the next.
There were red plastic books listing what things to scavenge in the outside world, what to look for, what to protect. Row upon row of rather basic laptops, each component individually plasti-sprayed to protect from moisture and rust. At worst, Lenk said proudly, these machines would last 70 years. At best, some of them might last out the 300 years. They contained vast databases, electronic encyclopedias. In 12 different plastic-lined cells around the complex, there were enormous seed banks, seeds hardened for a warmer climate, enough to restart a real civilization.
If you had 150 people here for 300 years, they could make it, said Lenk. And not many of them would have to be really smart, you see? The end of the world wouldn't be the end of everything.
Lenk imagined a new kind of monastery,
a self-sustaining organization that could bring knowledge through a dark bottleneck of human history and allow it to flow freely again when the years became favorable. Martha had understood his vision better than anyone alive, and she had made it real. For food, his islanders would have options. The easiest would be hunting, fishing, small-scale arable farming. There was plenty of land, and the waters teemed with fish. There was even an area of the island suitable for grazing sheep if they brought them and managed the numbers carefully. But, Lenk was boyish and ebullient as he explained this, the genius part was the algae that grew in specially bored holes and crevasses all over the island.
"I saw it the day we arrived, but I had to be sure it was the same thing. I know now it is. We found this algae and cultivated it. It's the answer. It strips out nuclear waste, poisons, chemical weapons, everything currently being made and a few things that haven't been yet. The algae breaks nutrients to the atomic level and then builds them up again into a pure, beautiful, protein-rich, omega-3-filled, all-around food source."
The algae was his plan. In extremis, in the event of multiple catastrophic events, the green-brown algae on this island would sustain humans indefinitely. If sheep survived, they could eat the algae and remain healthy. It was a complete protein and fat source with no missing essential nutrients. They could harvest, dry, and store it. They could plant more on the mainland if they got there. He had eaten it himself, gone for a whole month without any other food, just to see how it went.
"Never felt better," he said. "Never felt clearer in my mind. If everything else fails, this will work."
Jun found a strange, impressed half-smile creeping across her face. This was his real passion, and he was significantly better at this than anyone she'd ever spoken to before. And she knew people who were passionate about surviving the apocalypse. To the northeast, there were reed beds for cloth and paper, baskets and boats. To the south, shears and presses to cut apart scrap metal that washed ashore and make new tools. In the north, the rock wall was pierced like lace, the holes filled with pale, thin, translucent stones from the beach. If there was no nuclear winter or chemical poisoning, the people could live here rather than deep underground. There were dormitories, a large communal kitchen, and a wood-furnished communal eating hall like a monastery. Inside, the light was milky and bright like a cold winter morning.
"Different things will become important," Lenk told her. "Look at how quickly it's all happened already. We can't look to our past for help. We have to look at the lives of people who actually survived 300 dark years and what they thought were the best and most luxurious ways of life. Monks in their monasteries, colleges and ancient universities, kings with their household. Privacy is a modern invention. We won't want it so much now."
He was convincing, without apparently attempting to convince her of anything. It was like his showing her his cock, but much more intense. Like there was some organ Shun didn't even know anyone could have, and Lenk had opened his clothes up, and there it was. "Oh," she thought, suddenly figuring out what she'd known about these suits, and almost telling Lenk, but looking at his face, it wasn't the moment. It was like he was showing her his dreams, because he had enough money to turn the dreams inside his head into something other people could walk around and live in. There was, to Trun's surprise, a chapel, an ecumenical, ribbed and vaulted stone structure to the east of the great house, built to face the rising sun at dawn. There were no overt religious symbols. Lenk called it the Still Stone Place.
"What the fuck?" said Trun.
Lenk shrugged.
"When the world goes away, people need it."
He paused, thought about it.
"Or if they tear it down and make something different, maybe that'd be even better."
It occurred to Chun then that Lenk knew instinctively what would make people happy. All the visionaries who had imagined these new technologies into being had that. They had something in their minds that let them abstract away from the people who were actually in front of them to a kind of general human. They knew how to make that general human happy, and that was why they were so good at withholding it or doling it out in tiny, perfect slices. If you know how to make people that happy, You know how to make them miserable as shit. Whatever this island world could be, take it away. If they want nature, make them look at screens. If they like quiet, make the world noisy. If they want community, split them up. If they want time to think, interrupt them all the fucking time. If they want real human companionship, tempt them with artificial matchbox and bead fantail pals. The island, Jun thought, is Lank's attempt at penance. He thought he could save a few people from all the shit he'd done. So, said Jun as they walked back toward the crack in the mountain together. This is a confession, right? You did this. You brought down the plane. You came here on purpose. Lank's suit shook its head.
It's a coincidence, said Lank. It's a fucking coincidence, or...
His head wobbled on his neck, rattling a thought loose.
Look, he said. The last time I spoke to Martha, she said, thanks for having me on the team.
I don't think that means anything.
Maybe it does. Maybe it's a bit like saying, we're on a team together. Just trust me.
That's a lot to read into it.
Martha's good at that. She says that, and then we arrive here. And then you arrive here. I keep thinking maybe she did this, you know? There'll never be an electronic trail. It happened as safely as it could without also being detectable in any way, forever, no matter how hard anyone looks. Martha knew this island was here. She knew we'd prepared it.
You think she brought down your plane?
I mean, it came down with a lot of warning, like we were supposed to survive it. She could have made it look like we were attacked, but actually it was, I don't know, pre-drawn lines of explosive in the fuselage. We came down with crash jackets and stoat boxes full of supplies and survival suits. Like this plan was part of Martha's secret protocol if the world ended. And if that's true, it means that when things are easier outside, people will be coming here. I'm the first.
Do you think the others know, asked Jun, that it's your island? Because that seems like it could cause some problems.
Someone knows, said Lank. I'll show you.
In a room toward the east of the cave complex, lined with shelves, 20 long-range communicators were smashed. Each one had been neatly and precisely destroyed with what looked like a single hammer blow to the center of the equipment. In 3 storage bins, the spare boards and chips were also very carefully and entirely destroyed. The array of aerials, each was snapped in half.
Nothing else? Asked Jun. Whoever did this only destroyed these? Nothing else, said Lank. So it's Zimri or it's Ellen. One of them has figured it out.
Couldn't it have happened before you got here? Long before? I mean, who knows how long this has been waiting here?
Don't be so naive, said Lank.
Look, said Jun. They had reached the curtain of creeper half concealing the entrance to the mountain, the place where the water trickled constantly down the cliff face. When we get out, there's something I need to show you about these suits. She stepped into the sunlight, her suit's visor momentarily darkened by the brightness. There was a clang that reverberated through her skull and a bright shower of pain cascading down her neck. She turned in agony. It was Ellen Bywater, readying her metal fist for another punch.